Before playing the sermon today, or the part of the sermon today, I'd like to play a piece of special music sung by Mrs. Sylvia Duke. A rendition of Psalm 22, Eli, Eli, Lama Sabachthani. But as you listen to it, I'd like you to imagine yourself as a Jewish disciple of Christ, who's heard and sung this specific psalm many times in the past, but this time it's right after having witnessed the crucifixion.
Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why out of sight, so far to hear my moan? Why day and night leave me alone? For you are home.
If you think about it, you know, a lot of people have used Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. You'll find it written in the Gospels. And it's, my God, why have you forsaken me? And people have speculated and thought, oh, well, God forsook him at that time. But it's a quote from the beginning of Psalm 22. And you do wonder, why is Psalm 22 in there? And whether, in fact, why did Christ mention those words? Is it only for our benefit? Or was it the fact that he also thought was going through his mind at that time the words of Psalm 22? Because he had to keep in mind the fact that the rest of the psalm would have to take place. Because the rest of the psalm is incredibly encouraging. I know it's a sad psalm. It's an ode, really. It's quite a sad psalm. But it nevertheless is incredibly encouraging when he starts talking about the fact that the ones from the dust will actually come and be raised and they will worship in the kingdom. And if you go and read Psalm 22, there is a great encouragement within there. It actually places the crucifixion in its context. But when you think about it, how these people must have felt if they'd sung that psalm many times before in the synagogue. And here they are, they have just witnessed the crucifixion. And they come to the synagogue and the psalm perhaps is sung again. And for the first time ever, they realize what the words actually were talking about. Now, you know, when I think back to what was happening in worldwide, and I think back particularly to what happened as far as the Psalms were concerned, as far as the hymnal was concerned, and the way that the Protestant hymns were actually inserted or were promoted, it was one of the first things that happened. When you understand what the Psalms are talking about to a large degree, they are talking to the people of God. They're designed to be sung within the temple of God. And that temple you and I are. Now, if those psalms were taken out away from us, and they were attacked. Protestant pap was put in its place. And really, it did not carry the inspired words that were there previously. The psalms themselves were labeled as poetic style and therefore could be dismissed. If you remember Psalm 105, where it talks about the healing, and you're looking there, they dismissed it. They said, oh, that's just a poetic style. It doesn't really mean what it says. But you know, that poetic style has meaning. The reason why they are sung is to get right into the very heart and core in every single one of us. You see, I could probably go ahead and sing that psalm from memory. If somebody starts you away with one of the psalms from this book, you could probably go ahead and sing them from memory. Because the music and the poetry carries it into the very heart and core of us, and we can memorize it. It's something that we carry around with us all day, every day. And I'm sure that as we go into the future, we're going to need these words. We're going to have to carry them around with us because, quite frankly, we are living in prophetic times. And that really is the title of the sermon, Living in Prophetic Times. I want to stress how important it is that we recognize that we are living in these prophetic times. I've got 5 points I want to deal with. The first two, I want to actually talk about the Psalms. I want to talk about how it interrelates to people like ourselves, as Christ was. Christ hanging on the stake was living in a prophetic time. The apostles, the early apostles, were living in prophetic times. And they had to recognize where they were. And so often we go through our life and we basically lose sight of it. We go through our daily grind and we lose sight of exactly where we are and how we are living in momentous times right now. So the first point I want to do is talk about how the Psalms tie in to this subject, because the Psalms do. The Psalms are prophecies, largely. Secondly, I want to examine one particular psalm, which I think, from what I can see of that psalm, we may well find that it's talking specifically about an event that you and I could well go through, a specific event. And if you look in the history of that particular psalm that I'll be dealing with, and I've asked the song leader to actually lead it as the final song, as the final hymn of today. So as you sing this particular psalm, you will think about the words that are there. But I want to have a look at this particular psalm. That's the second point. Thirdly, I want to look at prophetic timescales, because I think this is largely the problem that we have. So often we can look at things in our timescale, in the frail life that we have, and we can lose sight of the time scales that God uses. And I want to go back and look at really many events in the time scale that God uses. And then finally, I want to deal with one element that I think is very important. There's 2 points I want to cover in that. The first is the importance of one coming in the spirit and power of Elijah. Now, we look backwards at that, largely. But you know, there's also, it wasn't until I started looking forwards that I started to understand just how important the subject was. Because there are imminent dangers, and the fifth point I want to cover are the imminent dangers, and I mean imminent dangers to this church, and for us in Wales and the UK, and around this world, if we dismiss Mr. Armstrong as having fulfilled this. Because there are groups that we've linked arms with in the past, people that have been with us, that in fact have largely dismissed that, or have lessened that. And there are imminent dangers with doing that, and I want to bring those out. So those are the 5 points I want to deal with today. I hope we'll have enough time. I think we should do. I'll try and finish on time this time, with a bit of luck. So what about the Psalms? How do they tie in to living in prophetic times? Turn over to Malachi chapter 3. Malachi chapter 3, and we'll start here and just work from this point. Because Malachi chapter 3, we've read it over and over again. I want you to notice, though, it says, "Behold, I will send my messenger." I will apostolize, if you want to put it in Greek, my messenger. "And he will prepare the way before me, and the Lord who you seek will suddenly come to his temple." So it's the preparation of the very temple of God. Which temple you and I are? You go back to Ephesians, you find that is the case. "Even the messenger of the covenant," now that is the Christ that will return, "who you delight in, behold, he shall come, says the Eternal of Hosts. But who may abide the day of his coming?" And the word "abide" there is an interesting word. It literally means to be sustained. You'll find it if you want to look it up over in Genesis 45, I think it is verse 11. Yes, 45 verse 11. I've got to take the specs off to actually read it. But that's where Joseph actually preserves his family. It's a sustaining of his family. The same word is used. "So who may abide or be sustained in the day of his coming? Who shall stand when he appears?" Remember, it says, "Pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape these things and to stand before the Son of Man. For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. And he'll purify the sons of Levi." Now, the Levites actually served in the temple. They were the ones that actually did the work. Not just the priests. The priests, okay. The priests also served in the temple. But the Levites did the work. They really were the ones within that temple. And they were the ones doing the work of the temple. "And he'll purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer to the Eternal an offering in righteousness. And then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be pleasant to the Eternal, as in the days of old, and as in former years." So it's a case of, what is this offering? This offering of righteousness, and it's to do with the temple. And it's very, very clear, we've brought it out many, many times, that we're looking at the spiritual temple to which Christ will return. That's very much what we're involved in. Now, if we're looking at living in prophetic times, we understand ourselves as the spiritual temple, and we're looking at how the Psalms actually tie into that, and why, in fact, it was that they were attacked, and one of the first things that were attacked were the Psalms. Let's just turn over to 1 Chronicles chapter 6. In 1 Chronicles chapter 6, you find here how David set singers within the Levites. It was a vital part of the temple. It was a vital part of the actual work which the Levites had to do, was the singing. If you notice over in 1 Chronicles chapter 6, in verse 31, it says, "And these are they which David set over the service of song in the house of the Eternal, after that the ark had rest. And they served, they ministered, before the dwelling place of the tabernacle of the congregation with singing, until Solomon had built the house of the Eternal in Jerusalem, and then they waited on their office according to their order. So they basically spent their time in song as the temple was being prepared, waiting until they then sang within their order at a later time. If you notice in chapter 9, if you go down over to chapter 9 of 1 Chronicles, this was something that actually occurred day and night. And this is why the Psalms are so important. They're something that we can carry with us day and night. It's the Word of God that we carry with us. And over in 1 Chronicles chapter 9, notice in verse 33, "And these are the singers, chief of the fathers of the Levites, who remained in the chambers that they were free, for they were employed in that work day and night." Now, I remember when we were on the dig in Jerusalem, that at 3 o'clock in the morning, and if you go into any Middle Eastern countries, you'll find that the mullahs, the imams, I think they're called, aren't they? The kind of priests of the of Islam. But about 3 o'clock, they have a certain call to prayer, and you'll be woken up by this call. And in Jerusalem, we were actually staying in New Orient House, the New Orient House Hotel, which apparently is now the PLO headquarters. In fact, I've seen the front porch where we used to sit and drink Nesha beer, and that is the front porch of the PLO headquarters today. But we were staying there, it's just north of Jerusalem, and at night, I would wake up around about 3 o'clock as the mullah would sing, and it would drift across Jerusalem, and you'd hear this song, this call to prayer. Now, in ancient times, what you would hear at night would be music. It would be, in fact, there are certain psalms, specifically night psalms, and they're quite short, but you would hear that the singing of the Levites coming out from the temple, day and night. And at night time, obviously, when everything is very quiet, you would actually be able to hear them. Now, as I said, it's the temple that we are. And if you go into the front of your how this hymnal came to be written, in the front of this the Bible hymnal, you find the philosophy that Mr. Armstrong had. And he said here, "Having no hymnal of our own, I was forced to use one of the somewhat thin paperback Protestant songbooks. The elderly Bible scholar said it is just as sinful to sing a lie as to tell one, and I had to agree." Now, this is the philosophy that Mr. Armstrong had regarding this hymnal and why we have this as a part of our very spiritual heritage. He goes on, he says, "I knew that the Psalms were in fact songs or hymns, and it was clear in my mind that God's people should sing God's inspired words, not man's uninspired and often unscriptural words." Now, that is, again, that's the philosophy that Mr. Armstrong had. That is the way that we were taught. He goes on towards the end. He says, "Gradually through the years, succeeding editions of our hymnal have contained fewer and fewer of the old Protestant hymns and more of those composed by my brother. Now at last," he says, "the time has come that we can omit the old Protestant hymns almost altogether. It is indeed a happy achievement to have at last God's own hymnal for God's own church." Now, that was a condensed version of what he was writing, but it is interesting that that really lays out the way that we understood, the way that we formally understood, and it is interesting that these psalms were actually attacked. And part of the reason is that we, as we live through the prophetic times, if we've only got Protestant pap in our mouths and in our minds, we will not recognize certain things as they occur. There are words within this book which are prophetic, and words within this book which are definitely prophetic. And I'll come on and look at one of those. Turn over to 1 Chronicles. Notice in chapter 25, you're probably in 1 Chronicles still. I want you to notice what it says, the way, in fact, it describes what the Levites were doing when they were singing. Over in 1 Chronicles 25, notice in verse 1, it says, "Moreover, David and the captains of the host separated to the service of the sons of Asaph and Heman and Jeduthun, who should prophesy," notice, "prophesy with harps, psalteries, and cymbals, and the number of the workmen according to their service was," and it goes on, "of the sons of Asaph, Zakur and Joseph and Nathaniah and Azariah, the sons of Asaph, under the hands of Asaph, which prophesied according to the order of the king." It was a case of prophesying. You say, well, why? Why does it actually talk about it as prophecy? Well, if you notice in verse 7, it explains why. It says, "So the number of them with their brethren that were instructed in the songs of the Eternal." That's what the Psalms are. They are the songs, and they are prophetic. They carry the message from God. They are not just mere poetic words that can be dismissed and forgotten about. They carry message for God, and they carry it to the temple of God, into the heart and core of that temple, which temple you and I should be. That's why they're so important, and that's why they were attacked so early on in the apostasy. And we've got to really understand that and make sure that we keep those things in mind. Now, let's have a look at one of the Psalms, and this Psalm is Psalm 46. We'll go to Psalm 46. I'm not saying categorically that what I will give you today is absolute, you know, the way it is going to be, but everything seems to point in this direction. The way in which it was originally composed, we'll come to Psalm 46 later. If you want to turn over to Revelation 12, first of all, I want to show you something that is going to happen, Revelation chapter 12, and then I want to go and show you something in the background to Psalm 46 as to when it was actually given, and I want to show you how the possible future fulfillment and the fact that the church will be living through prophetic times, we may well find this psalm encouraging us, as Psalm 22 did, Jesus Christ himself. We may well find this psalm having been written for you and for me in a certain situation. So let's just have a look at Revelation 12 to start off with. Notice in verse 1 it says, "There appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars." Now this woman that gave birth to the man-child goes back long before the New Testament church. It goes back to ancient Israel. So when you're looking at Israel of old and the modern day Israel, in other words, the Israel of God, which you and I should be as part of that temple, there is a continuation from one to the other to a large degree, and it is given within this chapter, because this chapter is the interface between Satan and the true church or the true people of God. Now, if we skip down a little bit, go down to verse 13, just over the page in my Bible, it says, "And when the dragon saw that he was cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman that brought forth the man-child. And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she may fly to the wilderness, to her place, where she is nourished for a time, times and a half a time, from the face of the serpent." Now, we know, regarding the place of safety, you know, we understand what it's talking about. "And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood." Now you can turn over to, you put in your notes, Revelation 17:15. You find that waters are people. It is presumably an army that is pursuing the woman at this particular time, the true church, the Zion of God, "that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth, swallowed up the flood which the dragon had cast out of her mouth." Now there's a type and antitype. You can go back to the way in which Israel came out of Egypt and came to the Red Sea, and the Red Sea split and they went through and then came over the army that was pursuing them. It appears as if at the end time something similar will happen, but in this case it will be the earth that in fact helps the woman in some way and protects the true church, the true people of God. Now that is the event that we know is going to actually occur. It's probably going to be one of the most traumatic periods that you and I will live through. Can you imagine it? Now, to Christ, I mean, he had been praying for 3 hours before he finally was nailed to that stake. And during that time on that stake, he issued those words, "Lama Eli Eli Lama Sabachthani," quoting the 22nd Psalm, because it was talking about him then. He was living in prophetic times. Now, this particular psalm that we want to go on and have a look at, as I say, it seems to be a psalm that we will go to receive encouragement for as we go through an event like this. Whether, in fact, it is specifically about it or not, it doesn't make any difference. It is still a psalm that we will go to and we will receive encouragement from. Before we do, I want to go and have a look at the person who, by tradition, is the person who wrote it. It wasn't David. If you go back to Isaiah chapter 1, but in Isaiah 1, you will find probably the time at which this was written. Now, as I say, by Jewish tradition, it was actually written by Isaiah. And the book of Isaiah is really, as Mr. Armstrong brought out in the sermon, I think it was about Philadelphia, he was saying that this book, the entire Bible, was primarily written for the Philadelphia era. This book has been preserved so that you and I have got something to refer back to. Isaiah isn't written for the time in which it was written. It was written for us today. And if you read what it actually says here in the first chapter, if I just hit just a couple of high spots, because it was at this time, if the tradition is right, that this psalm that we're going to have a look at was written. And in Isaiah 1, notice in verse 1, it says, "The vision of Isaiah the son of Amos, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah." Now we need to go and have a look at, if you want to do it in your own time, if you want to have a personal Bible study, who are these kings of Judah? When did they actually live? They were living at the time before and during the time that Israel in the north was taken away captive by the Assyrians. It's the lead-up to the time of the Assyrian conquest of the northern tribes. But notice who it's addressed to. It's addressed to Judah and Jerusalem. And throughout the book of Isaiah, it's talking about Zion. Now, Zion was the hill somewhat south of Jerusalem, which was the citadel. And there was then the Milo between Zion and the Temple Mount, which was Mount Moriah. But the whole area was walled. So Zion started to be referred to for the whole area, including the Temple Mount as well. It was where the Temple of God is, or was, and is today. So when we're looking here, it says, "Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Eternal has spoken. I've nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The oxo is its owner, and the ass its master's crib. But Israel does not know my people, do not consider." Now, there are two different tribes being mentioned, two different peoples being mentioned throughout the entire book. You're looking at Zion, which is in the south, and you're looking at Israel, which were the northern tribes that were eventually taken away captive by the Assyrian invading forces. If you go on a little bit into verse 8, it says, "And the daughter of Zion is left as a cottage in a vineyard and a lodge in a garden of cucumbers and as a besieged city." Now indeed, that's what happened in ancient times. Zion, Jerusalem, was left. But the northern tribes were taken away. If you go on a little bit further, it talks about, "Except the Eternal hosts had left us a very small remnant, would have become as Sodom and Gomorrah." And it says, "Except for the elect's sake, these days shall be shortened." Because of the elect's sake, the days are going to be shortened through the time that you and I live in. And if we go over to chapter 2, it's very, very clear that what Isaiah is talking about is not the time back then. because it says, the word that Isaiah the son of Amos saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, same people it's talking to, and it's the same time frame. It's concerning these kings. It's concerning the time that the 10 tribes will be taken to will be taken captive by the Assyrians. But he's talking to Judah and Jerusalem, the people around Zion, the people who are supporting of Zion. And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Eternal's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. And many people shall come and say, come and let's go up to the mountain of the Eternal, of the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us of his ways and walk in his paths, for out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem. This book is not about ancient Israel. It is about today. It's about the end time. And as you go through the entire book, it's very, very clear that that is the case. Now, if we go over the page, a few pages, into chapter 36, we find described here the time frame that, as I say, traditionally, this psalm that we're going to look at was written in. And this time frame was a certain occurrence when the northern tribes had actually been taken captive, and Rabshakeh of Sennacherib's army, the head of the army, came outside the walls of Jerusalem, outside the walls of Zion, and started taunting God himself. And in Isaiah 36, notice in verse 1, it says, and it came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the defense cities of Judah and took them. And the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem to the king Hezekiah with a great army, and he stood by the conduit of the upper pool. Now the water was being brought in. In fact, what happened is Hezekiah made preparations before this occurred, and he dug a tunnel from the spring which was outside Zion into Zion itself. He tunneled through the limestone, and you can go to Jerusalem to this day and you can walk through Hezekiah's tunnel, and the water comes up around about your knees, and you can walk through that tunnel, and you can actually see the marks. They had some kind of a machine that they used to cut through the limestone. And that tunnel, then they sealed off the wells which were outside and made sure that nobody could then find them, and the waters then were inside Zion, the living waters within Zion. And it talks in here, in chapter 37, verse 6, it says, and Isaiah said to them, thus shall you say to your master, thus says the Eternal, do not be afraid of the words that you've heard, wherewith the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Behold, I'll send a blast upon him, he'll hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I'll cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. So this was a prophecy that Isaiah gave. If you go down to verse 14, it says, and Hezekiah received a letter. So what happened then, instruction to leave the area, but they sent a letter then to Hezekiah saying, don't you worry, we'll be back. And it says, he received the letter and he went up to the house of the Eternal and he spread it before the Eternal. So the army presumably was still outside at that time. And in verse 21 it says, Isaiah the son of Amos sent to Hezekiah saying, thus says the Eternal God of Israel, whereas you have prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria, this is the word which the Eternal has spoken concerning him. The virgin, notice that, the virgin. Now the true church is a virgin. The woman in the wilderness that the flood was poured out after, in Revelation 12, is a virgin waiting for Christ's return. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, has despised you, laughed you to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem has shaken her head at you. And in verse 36, notice what it says. It says, then the angel of the Eternal went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. Now, if you put together, if you want to put in your notes, 2 Chronicles 32, verse 21, 2 Chronicles 32:21, you don't need to turn there. But you will find that this 185,000 men were not just 185,000 of the army. They were all the leaders. They were all the great warriors. His entire fighting force was utterly, utterly destroyed. And when they rose early in the morning, notice what it says, early in the morning, behold, there were dead corpses. Now, if we go over to Psalm 46, I want you to notice something. Because just as Isaiah, as we noticed in Isaiah chapter 2, it's not talking about that time that they were in. So this psalm, although the tradition has it that it was written by Isaiah, it's not talking about the salvation of Israel or of Zion at that time. It's talking about a different time. I want you to notice over in verse 9, it says, "He makes wars to cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in sunder. He burns the chariot in the fire. Be still and know that I am God, and I will be exalted among the nations." Now the fact that wars are to be ceased at the end to the ends of the earth indicates the end time fulfillment. It also, the word "be still and know that I am God," you can go back and you can check it yourself in Exodus 14, you'll find that that's exactly what was said when Israel came out of Egypt, and Moses said, "You be still," or God said to Moses, "Be still," and you'll then see the hand of God that dealt with the enemies. And I say, if this psalm is not specifically talking to us about the events that we find over in Revelation 12, it nevertheless is the same kind of psalm that we would use at that time to receive encouragement. Let's just go through it. God is our refuge and our strength, a help in times of trouble. And as I say, remember. And one thing I also point out, if you notice in the King James, it says, to the chief musician for the sons of Korah, a song upon Alamoth. Now, that's not what it says in the original. You go back and get an interlinear, and you find that it does not say a song upon Alamoth at all. It says a song of the virgins. Now, the Alamoth is a high instrument, and they inserted that. It's like the virginal. You've heard the virginal, the ancient, I think it was a stringed instrument, the virginal. But that was because it was a high instrument, and that's why they've inserted that there. But that's not what it says in the original. It's a song of the virgins, and it talks about the virgin daughter of Zion. And as I say, it's not talking to them. It's talking to the same woman. We're talking to the virgin daughter of Zion in the end time. God is our refuge and strength. He's a present help in times of trouble. Therefore we will not fear. Though the earth be removed, though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though we know that the very nations that we've just left have in fact going to be swamped because it's the time of Jacob's trouble. It's the time of the Gentiles, and the very sea of the Gentiles will swallow them up. Though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof, though these armies, this flood that comes out of the very dragon's mouth, it doesn't matter. We don't fear. We don't have to fear. There is a river, the streams which will make glad the city of God. The very Spirit of God that is in us causes us not to fear. The holy place, the tabernacle, the dwelling of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. Zion, the very woman, the virgin of God, waiting for the very Christ to return. God shall help her. And it says that right early in the King James, but in fact, if you look in the margin, it says, when the morning appears. Sorry. When the morning appears. So it looks as if this will happen. And you imagine yourself, you've come through a very traumatic time. You've fled. You see the armies of the beast pursuing the true church. And you're looking down onto a plane. You can see the dust cloud as it appears and comes towards you. And it's the, you know, from this psalm, if this psalm is what it's what I believe it's talking about, you know that in the morning light, that's when the relief will occur. The heathen raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice and the earth melted. The earth melted. It's the earth that helps the woman. That is how this occurs. The God, Eternal of Hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Selah, think of this. Come and look at the works of the Eternal. What desolations he's made in the earth. But he makes wars to cease to the ends of the earth. We put it into its context. Yes, it's a time of trouble. Yes, we're going looking at tribulation on the entire earth. But you put it in its context, the same as Psalm 22. These psalms are meant for the true church. They're meant for the true church to carry within their very mind and heart and being. The bow, he breaks the bow. He cuts the spear in sunder. He burns the chariot in the fire. Be still. Know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I'll be exalted in the earth. The Eternal of Hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Selah, think of that. Now that is the psalm that I think may well, it certainly be a psalm that we will use as we see these things occur. And I think the background to it certainly indicates, as far as I'm concerned, it indicates not the fulfillment of Isaiah, who is the one traditionally to have written it, and the time of Hezekiah, but in fact a future fulfillment, a fulfillment that you and I will live through, we'll see, and we'll use the word of God to receive encouragement by. Why? Because we're living in prophetic times. And at that time, we will see prophecies unfold in front of our eyes. And we will need the word of God. We will need to know where we are at that time, what in fact will happen. I mean, if we see this army coming towards us, and it's, you know, it's getting very, very near, and sunrise is just occurring, the very fact that it says that it's in the morning that it will actually help, it could well be that that will give encouragement, and when we will see the hand of God actually occur. But you see, the problem today is that it's so difficult for us, as we go about our daily grind, to keep these things in mind, to see ourselves in the position that we find ourselves in today. So often we can go through the daily grind and we see only what we see. We see just as the world sees. We see the what's happening in Iraq at the moment, yes, but we can't see where it's leading to. We see what's happening as far as the world is concerned. You know, the mortgage is due or whatever, the various financial difficulties that we have. We need to look at prophetic times, or the prophetic timescale, God's way. Turn over to Jeremiah 32. Jeremiah chapter 32. You see, what we are preserving, what we have to hang on to, is not something that we're just using at this particular time. It's like Christ at Psalm 22. It put the prophetic time that he was living through, the time of incredible stress, into its context. That, you know, in the time to come, they will look and they'll say, ah, yes, this man has gone ahead and he's done this. And they will look at him and it will cause those in the dust of the earth to be resurrected. It will actually allow God's plan to take place. Now, when we turn over to Jeremiah 32, if you notice over in verse 37, it says, behold, I will gather them out of all countries, wherever I've driven them, in my anger, in my fury, in my great wrath, and I will bring them again to this place, and I will cause them to dwell safely. Now, it's type and anti-type. Yes, it was done in the past when Judah came back. But it says, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God, and I will give them one heart and one way. You see, what we have as a spiritual heritage is a way. It is a way of life that has been given to us. It's coming from one heart, one way, one spirit, one baptism. We're going to have to teach that way in the future. That's why it's so vitally important that we hang on to that spiritual heritage, that we go back and we look at the administration and the way the administration worked in the past. And I don't mean the administration, you know, just underneath Mr. Armstrong, because in several cases, that administration was wrong. I mean the administration that Mr. Armstrong himself used, because that was sometimes different. Those underneath him were often harsh. That was not the way Mr. Herbert Armstrong was. He just wasn't. He was a gentle, loving, kind man, to a fault. To a fault. And that's the way that he taught. Unfortunately, some underneath him did not go that way. They did not go that way. And some people learned a false way, even within the church. But that's not the way Mr. Herbert Armstrong was. And I'll give them one heart, one way, that they may fear me forever, for the good of them and their children after them, and I will make an everlasting covenant with them, that I will not turn away from them to do them good, but I will put my fear in their heart, that they will not depart from me. That is an end time fulfillment. That's what we're looking forward to. The difficulty is that this one way, this, and remember, we're talking about, remember the woman in the wilderness, the one with 12, you know, the 12 stars? If we go and we turn over to Isaiah 55, we are being prepared at this time. We are being made ready as the bride of Christ so that we can then govern, so that we can then be used in the very kingdom of God to teach this way to God's people, Israel. And it will be Israel, and from there the entire earth will then receive rescue, salvation. But it will be to Israel initially. But in Isaiah chapter 55, it says in verse 7, it says, let the wicked forsake his way. We've got to get away from our own ways. The unrighteous man, his thoughts. And let them return to the Eternal, and he will have mercy upon him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not yours. They're not your thoughts. I think in a different way to you. Neither are your ways my ways, says the Eternal. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. We need to look at prophetic timescales, God's way. We've got to try and get ourselves behind God's eyeballs and look at the world from his perspective. That is what we need to do. And it goes down, it says, for as the rain comes down and the snow from heaven and returns not there but waters the earth. Now, notice what he's saying here. He says the rain comes down, it goes into the earth, and it says, and it makes bring forth a bud. So it goes from the earth into the plant and goes and starts the bud. So there's the rain now in the plant. That it may give seed to the sower. So the rain then becomes the seed and is given to the sower. And also bread to the eater. The rain now has become actually bread. So that word, that rain that goes down. And remember it talks about the rivers. We just read that in Psalm 46. The very Spirit of God. But it says, so shall my word be that goes forth out of my mouth. It shall not return to me void. It will accomplish that which I please. It will prosper in the thing in which I send it. When God says something, that will be done. That will definitely be done. So when we're looking at the, you know, God's way, God's words, this is the problem. We so often we can lose track of this. It even talks about the way in which all things, everything that exists, it actually hangs on the very word of God. If I can just make an analogy with a computer. How many of you used a computer? I use a computer fairly regularly. Most of you here have used a computer. And you use a computer and you've got a window on the screen. And you get a mouse and you get hold of that window and you resize it. Or you drag the window around or you move the window around. You may think that you are actually doing that. You're not. You are not doing that. All you're doing is moving a mouse around. What is actually happening are the words of the programmer are in that machine. It's happening at a fantastic speed. I mean, you're looking at as the speed of a computer goes up, so the number of instructions a second goes up. But you're looking probably at 100 million instructions a second. It happens at a phenomenal speed, which makes it look like magic, but it's not. The actual words of the programmer are still there. They are still controlling that machine. It is not you. You are moving that mouse, but the programmer is moving that screen. Now, if you turn over to 2 Peter chapter 3, so often we lose sight of this regarding God. Remember, God's ways are not our ways. His thoughts are not our thoughts. He says, as the heavens are higher than the earth, they're greater than ours. In 2 Peter chapter 3, he says, the second epistle, beloved, I now write to you, in both which I stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets, and of the commandments of us, the apostles of the Lord and Saviour. So in other words, get your mind back on what the prophets foretold. Why? Because you're living in prophetic times. And those prophets are talking about times through which you and I are going to live. Knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers walking after what they want, after their own lusts, after what they want, and saying, where's the promise of his coming? I mean, Mr. Armstrong's been dead 17 years. Surely, we've got to move on now. We're not going to be frozen Armstrong. We've got to move on from that. We've got to start now moving on as a church and making sure that our children, our grandchildren, shall still hold to the truth. Because within this world, as the world goes on. For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. For this they are willingly ignorant. For by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water. God said, let there be light, and there was light. He's the programmer. He's the one. And the word didn't disappear. It stays there, making that sun, keeping the sun in position, allowing the earth to go around, and the very fabric of what we live in is held there by the very word and the Spirit of God. And it's held there now. It says, as the rain comes down, it doesn't bounce up, but it carries on, so will my word accomplish everything that I send it to do. And he says, whereby the world that then was being overflowed with water perished, but the heavens and the earth that are now, by the same word, that same word that created all things, are being kept in store, reserved to fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. That is what's keeping this world as it is now, at a foundational level. I'm sure Satan's got some of his words in there as well, some of his viruses and programs or whatever else are in there causing problems. But at a foundational level, it's the word of God that controls all that is. And it says, but beloved, notice in verse 8, do not be ignorant of this one thing. You know, here are people that are saying, look, things are going to go on. Things are going, you know, we're not in the end time now. As it says, there'll be scoffers walking in what they want to do, saying, where is the promise of his coming? It's not here yet. But beloved, don't be ignorant of this one thing, that one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. Now the programmer, you know, if I was running a program on the computer, there's a little tool that you can use, a piece of software called a debugger. Now this debugger you can actually run at the same time, and you can freeze a program dead. There's an interrupt called interrupt 13, and you can actually stop the whole machine. And you can go and look at all the variables, and you can do whatever you want to do with the variables, and then you can step it. So a day is like 1,000 years. You can take a day. You know, I've heard of cases where, I can remember one particular man I talked to, where he was driving down the road. He was on the Plain Truth distribution. He was working for the work, driving down the road, came to an intersection, and a car came straight across the intersection, and the two cars passed through each other. Now, I talked to the man who actually sat in one of those, the car, and he said, look, this happened to me. Because I said to him, I heard about this that happened to somebody, you know, from way back. He says, yeah, I was the one. And how do you do that? How do you get two cars to go through each other? You see, with the Word of God, it is, I don't say it's easy. I don't know how easy it is. I have no idea at all. But it says a day is 1,000 years. He can stop something and he can step it through and allow two to go through and then start the whole thing again if he wants to. But the other interesting thing is that the way God is the eternal. God also looks at this time that we are in a very different way. He says, look, 1,000 years is a day. You and I are living through a week in God's time. And if we just go back, let's go back to Daniel chapter 12. Daniel chapter 12. There's a scripture here in Daniel 12. So often we go out and we get in our cars and we drive down the road and we work on our computers, we do whatever work we happen to do. We drive our dumper trucks or whatever we happen to do. And we think, well, life has always been like this. It has not always been like this. We live in unique times. And we look at these times in relation to one another as God looks at it, as 1,000 years being a day, then we can see that when it talks here in Daniel chapter 12, notice it says in verse 4, one of the signs that we're looking for, it says, but you, Daniel, shut up the words, seal the book to the time of the end. Many will run to and fro, they will rush back and forth, and knowledge will be increased. There are two things that seem to characterize our time in which we find ourselves. That is communication and science. Communication and science, really, it's our world. All these lights, you know, the actual materials, the varnish that's on the lectern here. This thing is plastic. The technology that's carrying my voice across the internet. You know, we look at it and we think we just almost take it for granted that this is the way it's always been. It jolly well hasn't. You look back just a few years, you wouldn't be able to do what we're doing now in the technology sphere. But let's just have a look. I did this at the feast this year over in the UK, and I think people appreciated it, and I think it's worthwhile. Let's just look at the world in these 6,000 years, from God's perspective. I mean, okay, Adam was created, and Eve was created, the sunset on the beginning of the Sunday, it would be Saturday night, wouldn't it? But there he was going ahead and he was created at that time. You know, Adam then lived, as far as God was concerned, right through Sunday. Almost to the end, almost right through to the following sunset. Because he was 900 and some odd years old. So Adam was around right the way through, all the way through Sunday night, all right the way through Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon, in towards the afternoon, mid-afternoon, towards the end of the afternoon. He died, as far as God was concerned. And time went on, and the wickedness of man became great. That was Monday. It was kind of Sunday night, going into about midnight on the Sunday night, coming into Monday. And just after the sun came up on Monday morning, then we had the flood. So Monday, we had the flood. Just as the sun came up, we had Noah, we had Shem, and they lived a great deal of time. They, in fact, lived right the way through. Shem lived right the way through Monday, the rest of Monday. He lived right into Monday night, and in Monday night, along came Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all Monday night. And he saw these people, and then Joseph. And Joseph, in the actual night, he's now going into Tuesday, early, very early Tuesday morning. You've got Joseph and his descendants, and you find Israel actually starting to expand within Egypt. And then you come to Tuesday morning, and you have the Exodus. The Exodus occurs on Tuesday morning. time goes on, eventually they ask for a king. That's about Tuesday night. So it's Tuesday evening, and they ask for a king, and David is then made king as darkness falls. And you then go into Tuesday night, about midnight or so, Israel falls. Israel is then taken captive. And about as the sun comes up, you then have Judah. In about 535 BC, you have Judah then goes into captivity as well. And at that time, then obviously you've got the prophet Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar, and in the pagan kingdoms, this is Wednesday, you've got the Chaldeans. Well, this is all during Wednesday, during the actual daytime. You've got the Chaldeans, the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans, one after another. That was just Wednesday, as far as God is concerned. You then come to Wednesday evening, and Christ appears on the scene. Christ lives a very few years, a very short time, just a few minutes, and dies. Now, we're looking now, going into the Roman Empire. It's the night time, going from Wednesday, going into Thursday. And about as the sun comes up on the Thursday, then you've got the very Justinian and the Holy Roman Empire comes onto the scene. The church is, you know, almost extinguished to a large degree through these Middle Ages. But that's on Thursday. And then you come to Thursday evening. You come to William the Conqueror. The last time that the UK was actually invaded, that would be Thursday evening, just about as the sun set. That's the time that UK and England was invaded for the final time. But you then start looking at Friday. And it's Friday that's interesting. One day. And, you know, you and I know that Friday is a preparation day. Friday you prepare for the Sabbath. You get all your chores done, and you get all the bits and pieces done, and you tend to do it in the daylight portion. And the Sabbath here is about 5:15, is it? Round about that kind of time? So that's what I've calculated made my calculations based on. But around about 5:15, something like that, we're looking for the Sabbath to occur and the return of Christ. And you look at Thursday evening, about 7 o'clock in the evening, about 7 o'clock in the evening, the compass is invented. Before that time, they didn't have a compass. They navigated to largely, now they probably had stones, so maybe years before they had stones, perhaps in Roman times they did, but in Middle Ages they didn't. So the compass was invented, so the travelling starts to be able to be a much greater degree. You then have about midnight that Thursday evening, Friday, you're looking at the Black Death is raging over in Europe. There's no America at all. America, the Indians are here. America doesn't exist as a nation at all. Printing starts in Europe with the Gutenberg Bible about 3:30 in the morning on Friday. No printing before that. You couldn't get a book. The books had to be handwritten. 3:30 in the morning on Friday. Columbus finally sails the ocean blue. And, I've got 1493, 1492. And that's about 4:30 on the Friday morning. So Columbus finally discovers America. Martin Luther begins Protestants. That's about 5 o'clock in the morning. The King James Version of the Bible, this Bible that I'm holding here now, is about 7:30, Friday morning. And we're just now, the sun's coming up, we're getting ready, it's the preparation day. The Mayflower sails from Plymouth and lands at Plymouth Rock. That's about 7:45 that morning on the Friday. For the first time, just before 8 o'clock, a man called Harvey in the UK discovers how blood moves in the body. Nobody knew that before. Now, probably they did in certain other cultures, but not in Europe. Harvey understood that the heart pumps the blood around the body. Alchemy, basically, was dispatched to history by a man called Boyle with experimental chemistry. That was about 8:30 in the morning. Now, the sun's well up. And the day is coming into the day then. But the first mechanized industry of any kind, really, didn't start until about 930, it's starting in the UK. And still, over here, there's no real nation to speak of at all, certainly no nation. The first modern canals started in Britain about 11 o'clock on the Friday morning. In 7 years, they had built 4,000 miles of canal in the UK. Now, there's no car, there's not even a steam train, nothing like that. And you're already about 11 o'clock and coming up towards midday. About 11:30, the 4th of July, 1776, America becomes a nation. But notice how long it is. You were just coming up to the end of the morning on the Friday. James Watt's steam engine actually is 11:30. 11:31, James Watt invents his steam engine over in the UK, and that is used to pump the mines out. And they pump the mines and therefore are able to mine a deeper mine, coal mine, get the harder anthracite, which is used then for industry. You come then into midday, and you're getting ready for the Sabbath. And the Sabbath, remember, is about 5:15. And you then get the first real paved roads start to appear. That's about 12:30. John McAdam. Tarmacadam. They begin to make tarmacadam roads. And the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the first Industrial Revolution, is about the same time. The first steam train, the Stephenson's Rocket, it actually ran from Darlington, which is where I was born, to Stockton, which I knew my father used to take loads to Stockton, which is just about 20, 30 miles away from Darlington. And that was in 1825, about 12:30 on that Friday afternoon. It went to get to the grand speed of about 35 miles an hour. So that was the start. That was the beginning of the railroad. 12:30 on the Friday afternoon. The first passenger steamship crossed the Atlantic in 1837. That was just before 1 o'clock. And remember, 1 o'clock, you've only got 4 hours to sunset. 4 hours to sunset. The penny post was invented around the same time, about 1 o'clock. Chloroform was discovered for operations. They didn't have operations until about 1 o'clock. Just after 1 o'clock, Samuel Morse began telegraphy. And suddenly messages could be transferred here, there and everywhere. Not across the Atlantic. There was no cables laid across the Atlantic. The first oil wells were about 1:30. The first gasoline engine, the first spark, the engines that we use in our cars, again, around about 1:30. So you're looking about 3.5 hours to sunset before you had anything even remotely looking like a car. There was nothing before that at all. You had the American Civil War around the same time, and just shortly later, about 1:35, the first transatlantic telephone cable was actually laid. It wasn't a telephone cable, it was a Morse code cable. But a cable was put across from Ireland, or it was actually from, I think, Nova Scotia across to Ireland. About the same time, 1869, the US was actually crossed by rail. The two ends met up, and suddenly you can go from the East Coast to the West Coast by rail. And the transportation then began. About 1870, the Bessemer converter halved the price of steel. So again, all these things are indicative. They're indicative to knowledge being increased, to the industrialized society that we've got today. At that time, at about 1:45, anthrax was killing 20% of all the sheep in France. 20% were dying from anthrax. Now, as we come up to 2 o'clock, by Pasteur and also Koch, they inoculated for anthrax and stopped that. So there was many, many other things in the medical profession that was happening around that time. The germ theory was put forward, again by Pasteur. We're looking at about 20 to 2, something like that. Antisepsis by Lister. They did not understand this. They did not understand about germs. and you're looking, coming up for 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and the Sabbath's about five. The telephone came into being about 1:45. And at that time, President Rutherford B. Hayes, he was apparently participating in a trial telephone conversation between Washington and Philadelphia in 1876. And he made the comment, he said, "That's an amazing invention, but who ever would want to use one of those things?" So that's what he said about the telephone. And that happened. And you were looking at just coming up for 2 o'clock on the Friday, on this preparation day. The petrol engine was fitted to bikes just shortly after 2 o'clock. There was no motor car, none whatever. And about 12 minutes past two, Mr. Herbert Armstrong was born. That was in 1892. And it's interesting that in 1895, Marconi invented wireless. And it was interesting, again, this was about 2:15. On the Friday afternoon, you're looking at about 2¾ hours before sunset. And it's interesting that what was said then by a man called Charles Dewell, who was the commissioner of the U.S. Office of Patents, because so many patents had been filed at that time, and he wrote a letter to President William McKinley suggesting that his office was abolished in 1899, because he said everything that can be invented has now been invented. So that's what he reckoned at that time. Coming up, that was about 1899. The Wright brothers flew in 1903, and that was about coming up to 2:30. So you're looking at 2½ hours to sunset. And at about the same time, the comment was made by Henry Ford's lawyer. The president of the Michigan Savings Bank advising Horace Rackman, who was Henry Ford's lawyer, not to invest in the Ford Motor Company in 1903, because he said the horse is here to stay, but the automobile is only a novelty and a fad. But he goes on, Einstein came up with his theory of relativity around that time, about 2:30, at about the same time as the Model T Ford. Vitamins were discovered around that time, about 2:45. Nitrogen began to be extracted from the air, again about 2:45, and that is significant because it not only gave fertilizers, it also gave bombs and the First World War. The gospel went by the US by radio at 3:15. Now, we've only got 1¾ hours to sunset, and the gospel begins to go to the US by radio. It hasn't been to the rest of the world yet. Plastic start, and polymers, about the same time. On July the 1st, 1945, about 3:30 on the Friday, and remember we're looking at the sunset about 5 o'clock, 5:15, the A-bomb was exploded, the first A-bomb. That was July the 1st. August the same year, Hiroshima occurred. And we're now into a different world altogether, a different order. The gospel then goes to via Radio Luxembourg about 3:40. And we're looking at you're looking at 5 o'clock, 5:15, as the Sabbath. Yuri Gagarin enters space just before 4 o'clock. There was no space at that time. Sputnik itself wasn't until about 3:30, or just shortly, it's about 3:40. And computers start to be used in industry around about 4 o'clock. Homosexuality becomes legal in the US just shortly after 4. We live in this world today and we almost look upon it as normal. It is not normal at all. There's less than an hour to go to sunset. Less than an hour to go to sunset that actually occurs. You look at Sodom and Gomorrah and how God actually dealt with that. The first handheld calculator is about 4:15, and we're looking at a sunset of about 5. Again, about an hour away. And then Mr. Armstrong dies around about 4:30. You've got about 3/4 an hour, something like that, to sunset. And yet people say, and they make these, you know, these claims, and they say, oh, well, Mr. Armstrong's dead. It doesn't really, we're living in the past. We don't go back and live in the past. But you see, you've got to put it into its context. You start looking at the world through God's eyes. You start looking at the way the world is in reality. As 1,000 years is a day, then you see that we're living in the end times. Now, there's one important element. I said I was going to end on time, didn't I? Anyway, let's see what I can do. Let's turn over to Matthew 17. Matthew 17. In verse 10, and his disciples asked him, saying, why then do the scribes say that Elijah must first come? And Jesus answered and said, truly Elijah shall first come and restore all things. And I say to you that Elijah has come already, but they didn't know him, and have done whatever they wanted. And likewise shall the Son of Man. And the disciples understood that he spoke to them of John the Baptist. But he says very clearly that Elijah shall first come. Now if we go over to Luke chapter 1, we will see very plainly in Luke chapter 1 that the prophecy about Elijah was fulfilled by John the Baptist at his time. And yet, if you want to put in your notes, I know you're turning there, in Luke chapter 1, but if you want to put in your notes John 10 verse 41, you'll find that John the Baptist did no mighty work. There was no miracle. And yet he fulfilled it. He said very clearly in Luke 1:16, many of the children of Israel shall he turn to the Lord their God. This was the spirit and power of Elijah. And he shall go before him in the spirit of the power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. That is the spirit and power of Elijah. Now, this is the problem. When we look back, and I've talked to some who say, well, this is only supposition. This is something people suppose. I mean, Mr. Armstrong himself never categorically said that he was the Elijah to come. He never categorically said. Well, he made some comments and he made it very, very plain that he identified himself as fulfilling that. He said he was not Elijah. Yes, he said that. But he very clearly showed that he was one coming in the spirit and power of Elijah. Very clear. And if you want, I haven't got time to give you the quotes now. If you want them, I can show them if you want to see me afterwards. But you know, some of the people that were actually with us at one time, that are separated from worldwide, that are with us, do not believe this. And I think the problem is that they look backwards. They do not recognize themselves as having living in prophetic times. They've lost the focus. Because when you look at yourself as living in prophetic times, you look forward. And you start looking forward, and you say, okay, let's imagine that Mr. Armstrong wasn't the Elijah to come. What does that mean? Well, it means that somebody else is going to have to come and restore all things. And from that all things having been restored, a falling away has got to occur. Now you see, what in fact happens is that when that occurs, there's some real, real problems. And as I say, the imminent dangers to this church and the people of God. It's not just this church. If we hold fast, we won't have the imminent dangers. But to the people of God, there are imminent dangers that are on the horizon. And we've got to be aware of that. And we've got to make sure that we understand foundations. We've got to understand prophetic times and where we are. And understand and hold those psalms. And to realize where we're going from this point. You see, looking forward, somebody else to come and restore all things undermines the spiritual heritage that we got from Mr. Herbert Armstrong. And you will find, I was just reading one of the magazines that were put out by one of the corporate churches just this morning. I saw one, I hadn't seen one for a year or 2 years. but this particular one I was reading, and it's interesting, there's not one word of Mr. Armstrong in there whatsoever. Some interesting articles, but you know, the fact that they do not recognize Mr. Armstrong as the Elijah, as the one coming in that spirit and power, then it is a problem. It is a major problem. If we just remind ourselves, let's have a look. No, we won't. Just put in your notes, 2 Thessalonians 2:3, it says that he will not come unless there's a great falling away first. It will not come unless there's a great falling away first. But if you turn over to 2 Kings, I want you to notice something. If we're looking forward, as I say, there is an imminent danger if we are not careful on this particular subject. 2 Kings chapter 1, if we notice in verse 9, it says, "The king sent to him a captain of 50 with his 50, and he went up to him, and behold, he sat on the top of the hill, and he spoke to him, 'You man of God, the king has said, come down.' And Elijah answered and said to the captain of 50, 'If I'm a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50.' And there came fire from heaven and consumed him and his 50. You see, some people are waiting for an Elijah to come who will fulfill this type of role. Now, as I say, this is very dangerous. If we look at the type that we are given, we find that no mighty work of this type was done. The Elijah that was John the Baptist, the one coming in the spirit and the power of Elijah, it was very clear that he fulfilled it. And it's also very clear that he did not do this kind of miracle. But if you notice, turn with me now to Matthew 24. I want you to notice something in Matthew 24, and notice very, very carefully. Matthew 24, if we notice in verse 23, well, in verse 22 it says, "Except those days are shortened, though no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake those days shall be shortened." Now that is indicative. It points us back to the very prophecy that talks about Elijah. It says, because he talks, unless Elijah actually comes, it says that he will destroy the entire earth. The entire earth is going to be destroyed. And it says, then, if any man shall say to you, 'Look, here is Christ,' or 'there,' do not believe it. For there will arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect." What I want you to notice, if you've got a King James Version, notice where it says, if it were possible. The words "it were" is in italics. They are not in the original. So you should read that section, and this is how it is actually in the original. It says, "False prophets and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if possible they shall deceive the very elect." The indication is that the purpose of those signs and wonders is to deceive the very elect. That's the indication. Now, if that is the case, if somebody is looking for an Elijah, if they don't recognize that, no, where we are in prophecy, we're living in prophetic times, yes, but where are we? If we get ourselves off kilter in that area, we can very easily be deceived. And you read through Matthew 24 and you will find deception repeatedly mentioned. And again, understanding that we are living in prophetic times, if you go to verse 34, it says, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass until all these things be fulfilled." We've got away from that in the past. We should go back to that. The indication is that we are now in that generation. How long is a generation? Well, I know this much, that if everybody dies out, then we're out of that generation. If everyone literally dies out, you know, we're not looking at hundreds of years, which some of these corporate groups are talking about. We are looking at a very short space of time. We're looking at prophetic times in which we're living. And we need to keep our minds and our noses in the book, ourselves on our knees, in contact with God, because that's where our strength is. So The church was living in prophetic times at the time of Christ. That psalm, Psalm 22, certainly helped, I personally think, Christ himself. I think that's why he quoted the beginning of it, and it probably the rest of it was going through his mind as he died, as he went through that time himself. Today we live in those prophetic times as well, and we need to recognize them. In the future, the true church is going to live in prophetic times and need to recognize where it's living and what it's living through. Truly momentous times. Now, we began with a psalm. We'll therefore end also with a psalm, and this time it'll be Psalm 46. So as you sing this psalm, we've gone through a little bit of its history, who wrote it. We've gone ahead and we've had a think about, well, how it can help us in the future as a church. I hope that you will also find the words encouraging as we actually sing that psalm as a close.